the toad. Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, light up my skirt. Get me up, be the biggest little flirt. Well, I might. Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Hey, welcome to the Shame-Free Zone. This is your host, Veronica Monet. This evening, we're going to be talking about food, nutrition, diets, health, and I have with me Michael Joseph. He is located in Florida, and he's got some, I think, kind of revolutionary takes on the whole diet nutrition thing, but I'll let you be the judge of that when, as you listen tonight. He's with Staff of Life Nutrition. He's actually the founder and director of the Staff of Life Nutrition Consulting. And also teaches, I guess he's an instructor at the Florida School of Holistic Living in Orlando, Florida. A very prolific writer. Just recently got one of his articles published in, I think it's Care Magazine. I'm going to let him tell you a little bit about that. Michael, welcome so much to the Shame-Free Zone. Glad to have you here again.
Thanks, Veronica. It's great to talk to you again and to be on the show. I appreciate that.
Yeah, and did I get that right? Was that Care Magazine?
Actually, I think it's called We Care Magazine. This is their third issue. And the article was just some simple ideas that somebody can use to get started in a new eating methodology that's based on their individual needs.
I just read it, as a matter of fact, found it really fascinating. I love the 10 things you can do to get started with a holistic way of eating. And right off the bat, you ask people to write down their goals. That is like one of the biggest problems, isn't it, about affecting change in one's life, is just getting clear on what you want and actually putting it down on paper where you tend to commit to it.
Yeah, I've noticed that a lot of people really don't have the opportunity to really ask for what they want, and I think that's where eating and sexuality kind of converge, or one of the places they converge, is this idea that we really can't ask for what we want for whatever reason. So with your diet and with your health, and especially with the food choices that you make, you really have to know what you want in order to know where you're going. Otherwise, you're just going to get whatever you get. So it's important to write your goals down and to have a really clear idea as far as what you want, whether it's to enjoy your food more or be more consistent or lose some weight or heal some digestive problems. It's just really important to know what know the why behind the action that you're taking for your diet and for your nutrition.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that makes you stand out, as being very unique and like I said, I think revolutionary, compared to many other people who are advising and coaching people around their health, is like item number 2 in your article says, start keeping a food, mood, and health diary. Now, a lot of people kept food diaries before, but you're asking people to actually chronicle their moods after they eat or during the eating. I don't know, but is it before, during, and after?
Well, really, it's all three. It's probably most helpful to have a baseline. Like, for instance, before you sit down to eat breakfast, you write down and say, I feel like I have energy, or I feel still tired, or I feel happy, or I feel moody. And then you write that down, and then you eat, and then after you eat, you write down how you feel, and you see if the food that you've eaten had any immediate effect on your emotions or your physical well-being. And you'll notice that a lot of times there's going to be a difference. Like sometimes when right before you sit down to eat, maybe you're a little, you might be low in energy, or you might have a lot of energy, and then after you eat, it might be something completely different, or it might be the same. The point is to try and recognize, how your food is affecting and how it's affecting your mood, how it's affecting how you feel. So if you make that connection between your food, your body, and your emotions, you can have a real, again, it's coming down to clarity and having a really clear picture as far as where you are. So I guess writing down your goals is setting up where you want to go, and keeping the food mood journal gives you an idea of where you are. So if you know where you are, you know where you want to go, you can get a really clear, you can put together a plan to get to where you want to get to.
Don't you think that one of the things that really gets an obstacle for people who want to obtain certain health results is the fact that they're not, every time they set about trying to make changes in their diet, they're not really in touch with how they want to feel. And I know that you really encourage people to have a sensual relationship with their food, and I'm just wondering if you have some tips for people on how they can find a balance between enjoying their food and making healthy choices. Because, you know, usually when I talk to my friends and we talk about eating healthy, quote-unquote healthy, there's a lot of, you know, kind of, oh, it's not much fun. It doesn't, like, make us happy. We just do it because we should.
Well, anybody that doesn't think that eating is fun or happy, they haven't hung out with a bunch of people from Mexico. Because people from South America and Central America, they know how to make food fun. I don't know if you've ever been to, if you have a lot of Spanish or ethnic friends, but the ethnic people know how to make food fun. And the problem is that this country has turned food into some sort of like a clinical thing where it's devoid of all emotion, where it's devoid of tradition. And the few times each year we actually have some sort of tradition, like Thanksgiving or the Christmas season or any type of holiday, it is over-inundated with, unfortunately, too much commercialism and too many things that really have less to do with the tradition and more to do with extraneous things. But food and eating is supposed to be fun. There's supposed to be times for celebration. There's supposed to be times for excitement and for a fiesta. But what happens is we run into a problem in this culture where we forget about the traditional, exciting, celebratory aspect of food, and we rely on food too much for entertainment. If you think about it, you go into the supermarket and there's a lot of food where you're seeing food for adults that have brightly colored lettering on the boxes, and you see a lot of convenience food and a lot of food that looks like it was, like put in a box that was to appease or relate to a child. And I think it's really interesting because with that, you actually get into a situation where you become very unconscious about your eating, and you start relying on food for entertainment and start relying on food for fun. And then yet when you get into the real food, it doesn't seem like it's so fun because it's very nondescript, it's very basic, and there's not really a lot of education as far as how to make real food something that's an enjoyable experience, when meanwhile traditional cultures all over the world, that's what they do.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah, actually, you talk about food being entertainment. I think here in America, we've got a strong connection between our junk food and various different forms of entertainment, whether it's the Super Bowl or going to the movies. Oftentimes, the junk food is associated with actually sitting down, watching something, and stuffing our faces.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's where you get a lot into unconscious eating. But let me kind of clarify something. Let me kind of throw a disclaimer out there that having a celebration with junk food, going out to the movies and having popcorn, or going to a barbecue with some friends, or having hot wings and a beer when you're watching the Super Bowl, there's absolutely nothing wrong with any of those things. The problem is when those things, the food as entertainment, becomes the norm. That's when you have a problem. That's when food that's not necessarily designed to be nourishment and not necessarily designed to be nutrition becomes nutrition. That's when you have a problem. So there's nothing wrong with even once a week on a Sunday, you get together with some friends and you have a good time, you go out and see a movie. There's nothing wrong with that. You're not going to get sick. it's not going to kill you. But when you're doing fast food 6 days a week, that's where it becomes a problem, and that's where it's a situation where it's just too much. But if that's your choice, that's fine, as long as you're aware of that. But I think a lot of people, they get into this whole idea that they can't have a bag of Doritos every now and then, and they have to be absolutely perfect, and that's the furthest thing from the truth.
Yeah, I actually saw an actor on a talk show the other night, and he was talking about, I think it was on the Jon Stewart show, and I don't remember the actor's name, he's a comedian, but he was talking about basically he'd gone off of sugar, and that he felt like he was very much like a drug addict or an alcoholic. He couldn't have a bite of sugar, otherwise it would be a relapse, and then he would wind up eating too much sugar.
You know, I'd be really interested to find out from this gentleman what sugary foods he was craving the most, because I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't necessarily white sugar, but it was foods that were made with white sugar that happened to have other ingredients in it, like dairy, eggs, or wheat. And this is something I think is really interesting. People that can't lay off of sugary foods, it's not like the first thing they're going for is a packet of Domino's sugar. The thing that they're going for is a donut, a pasta, bread, cookies, snack crackers, not even so much corn chips, maybe potato chips, but that's a little bit different. But a lot of times they're going for these like baked goods. And my thought is that there's probably a food allergy, food addiction situation there. So it's not necessarily just sugar, because the way that I look at it is that what is the addictive substance that someone is going for. Like if somebody's addicted to heroin, they're not gonna satisfy a heroin addiction by, going in and smoking a cigarette. So the way that I look at it is like, what is the food that's causing the craving? And it's almost always those baked goods. I say 90% of the time based on my experience and my research. So that's the one thing that I would like to see, that I'm very interested in learning about, is what were those foods that he couldn't lay off of? And if he was going and downing packets of sugar and sugar cubes, then that's a completely different situation altogether.
You're right. Nobody does that. No. It's about putting something sweet on usually, like you said, dairy and wheat products or gluten products, and having food allergies myself. I know as soon as, sometimes the way I could tell if a dish had something I was allergic to, you know, because I didn't know if somebody else picks it, I don't know what's in it. But it's like when I want to go back for second and third servings. And then I realize, there's probably something I'm allergic to in here, because it's like you can't turn it off.
Yeah, and what happens is that the hunger mechanism gets overwhelmed by the addictive mechanism, where under normal circumstances you would eat something and you'd be like, that's enough, I can't eat any more of this. But when you become addicted to something, you can't stop until there's nothing left in the box.
Right.
Like, there's this big thing that wheat thins are supposed to be really healthy. Yeah, uh-huh. They're really healthy if you can only eat like two or three, but I don't know anybody that doesn't finish the box.
Right.
So there are three really important characteristics to understand about wheat thins. They're crunchy, and the crunch sensation is a natural expression of aggression. It's a natural stress reliever. The second thing is that it's loaded with partly hydrogenated oils. Now, technically, they're not trans fats, but there's still hydrogenated oils in there that can add to a craving. And the third thing is that they're wheat. And wheat is one of the most addictive food substances in the world. So you put those three things in there, and it's going to be really, really difficult to lay off of something that's crunchy and that's also a snack cracker. That's why, you know, once you pop, you can't stop. And I know that was for Pringles, but, you know, that's why wheat things are not, don't believe the hype, wheat things are not healthy. They're not a healthy snack. If you like them, that's great, but don't eat them under the impression that they're healthy.
Yeah, exactly. Now, what about this? You know, I think that's kind of disturbing. I think, oh, my God, so if I'm eating crunchy food, I'm expressing aggression. Does that mean that we've got an anger management problem, or you said that's a natural expression of aggression?
It is. I mean, think about it. Whenever you get angry, the first thing you do is you grind your teeth. I'm sure that when mankind was evolving from primate, based on who you talk to, they showed their teeth, and aggression is something that's associated with chewing. It's the first reflex that we have to express any type of aggression or any type of fear. So a lot of times we have a lot of stress in our lives, and we don't have too many outlets to express that stress, and the first thing we're going to do is find something crunchy. And a lot of people that I've spoken to that have emotional eating or disordered eating situations, the foods that like their go-to foods, like their stressed out foods, like their pig out foods that they eat when they're stressed out, it's usually something like potato chips. In some cases, a lot of cases actually, baby carrots, crackers, crunchy cookies. They never go for the soft ones when they're stressed out, but they go for the crunchy ones, toast. These are all foods that are addictive foods, but also at the same time, they're crunchy. So when you crunch on them, it actually helps relieve stress. There's a hormone that's created when you chew a lot. And when that hormone is created, it actually satiates the body and it actually calms you down a little bit, which is perfectly understandable because the body wants you to chew your food because chewing is the most important aspect of your digestion. And it's the only aspect of your digestion that you have conscious control over. So there's a lot that goes into the mechanics of chewing, and stress relief is a very primal but a very important aspect.
Well, you know, it's really interesting because you have such a, it seems like a non-judgmental approach to, I mean, you just kind of report the facts. You don't necessarily tell people what they should do. Now, the government certainly likes to tell people what they should do. So does the medical profession. And I know that you have some pretty strong opinions about the wellness industry and the impact that it is having on women's body image. Did you want to speak to that some?
Well, this is really funny. Here you say, I'm not judgmental, but then you brought up the two things that I'm most judgmental about. And that's actually three things, and that's the United States federal government, the wellness industry, and the medical industry. Right now, the wellness industry and the medical industry are both just as corrupt because they're both, in my opinion, again, based on my research and the people I learned from and my experience, they're both selling a line of crap that a lot of people are believing, but it's not helping anyone. The first thing is the entire, you know, I think Western medicine is wonderful, but I think you run into a lot of problems when Western medicine professionals start ignoring food and they start saying, oh, well, you know, you've got cancer, you can eat whatever you want. Well, I wouldn't necessarily buy that. And then you have the wellness industry, which I have a major gripe with, where basically they say, you know, eat this, don't eat that, eat this, don't eat that. But whatever you do, make sure you buy this bottle of pills, this $70 bottle of supplements, because if you take this, it really doesn't matter what you eat. So the wellness industry, I think, it gets a little bit wrapped up in, a little bit too much wrapped up in the supplement thing, and there's not a lot of direction about food. I just got an email from a prospective client today about, you know, she was working with a nutrition professional who gave her no guidance. So that's something that is a constant story that I get is, you know, supplement pushers that are masquerading as nutrition professionals. And the third thing that absolutely grinds my gears, that just eats me up inside, is the United States federal government and this current war on obesity, which I think is really amazing because, you know, you could be accepted if you're any creed, color, race, religion, but if you're fat, you have a problem. We need to wage war on you. If you are overweight, then you're costing the government money. You're costing the people money. And according to one of my colleagues, if you're overweight, you're contagious and you're going to make everyone around you fat. So this,
how's that
absolutely
possible?
Well, there's this one woman that's all over Fox News who always talks about how people that are overweight are like bad. They're contagious. Like if you hang out with somebody who's overweight, you're going to become overweight because you're going to, like, you know, be a complete mindless troll and just adapt to all of their habits or whatever? Like is it, this person has absolutely no understanding of what causes obesity and what causes overweight, if it even exists. And, you know, to think that it's contagious, I think, is just a gross misrepresentation of science. And obesity really is, it's just a matter of perception. Because, you know, if I walked into a country that was poor and that country had, you know, massive starvation, I would be massively obese. But if I was hanging around a bunch of offensive linemen that, you know, played for the New York Jets, I would be really, really underweight. So it really is a matter of perception, and it's relative to the standards that you're gauging it by. But my biggest gripe with the government and this war on obesity is that they started it. They started this whole obesity thing by two things. First, they created the four food groups and then the food guide pyramid. And the four food groups basically told people to eat as much food as possible three times a day. And then the pyramid turned into 9 to 11 servings of pasta and bread and whole grains, but they never defined what whole grains were. And then they said 3 8-ounce servings of milk, and everyone knows that milk is supposed to make a baby cow into a 2-ton adult cow in 2 years.
Oh, my God. Say that again. You know, say that again. I've heard Bill Maher say, oh, milk is for baby cows, not for people.
But think about it. Milk is biologically designed to make a 160-pound calf, a baby cow, into a 2-ton cow, adult cow, in less than 2 years.
Oh,
that's
my
what it's
God.
Biologically designed to do. So what do you think is going to happen when a human being drinks milk? And here's another problem. Here's another problem with this too. In the past 60 years, whole cow's milk consumption has decreased, but skim milk consumption has exponentially increased every year. And skim milk is the number one most allergic food in the world. And I can't really get into it now, but I've found a lot of studies that have found a lot of supporting evidence that proves that food allergies can be one of the inflammatory factors, causative factors of overweight and obesity. And if you think about it, we are encouraging children to drink as much skim milk as possible because it's supposed to be good for you. And yet there was a recent study that I saw, I think it was from Austria, about childhood obesity, where they tested children that were obese and children that were of normal or below average weight for food allergies. And the children that had, and let me preface this by saying that the food allergens they tested for were milk, wheat, soy, eggs, and so on and so forth, like real commonly eaten foods, like the top 10 most commonly eaten foods in the world. Rice, I think, was another one. But they tested these two groups of children, and the control group, the children that were of normal weight or below average weight, a small percentage, I think, not really a small percentage, but like between, I think, 25% and 40%, I can't remember the exact number, came back with elevated antibody levels to these foods, whereas the children that were obese, every single one of them came back with elevated levels of antibodies to at least 3 food allergens. And they all had inflammatory indicators that were also elevated in their blood. So what this says to me is that this is one.
Before you make that point, just tell, what does inflammatory mean when it comes to allergies?
In a nutshell, low-grade inflammation is the result of chronic undetected food allergies. Basically, if you're eating a food that you're allergic to and you continue to eat it, what happens is that because of all the chemical reactions involved, the body actually becomes mildly inflamed. And if this continues over a consistent time period, then that inflammation can cause all different types of metabolic problems. And this, and inflammation is one of the major factors that is responsible for syndrome X, this syndrome that causes people to be lethargic, to have chronic fatigue syndrome, to be overweight, to have problems with their immune system. It's caused by inflammation, but they can't track where the inflammation comes from because they don't know where to start. And yet, when you look at food allergies and you look at what somebody's putting into their body and you look at the relationship between the digestive system, the immune system, and the food that people are eating, you can have a really, really, really good starting point, at least in my opinion, and based on, again, the people that I learned from, to recognize at least one major causative factor. But that's really a huge deal. Now, this is where that woman that I was telling you about that, like, says that fat people are contagious, this is where she doesn't understand that obesity and overweight is not necessarily a behavioral thing, but it could be something that's biological or physiological. It could be something that's the result of chronic low-grade inflammation. And that's what this study on childhood obesity basically proved. Every single child had elevated levels of anti-food antibodies than the kids that were of normal weight and underweight. Every one of them. They were all higher than the other ones.
You know, I'm not shocked, although it's shocking information. But I personally am not shocked because suffering from food allergies, I know that one of the things that it does to me, you know, is add a roundness to my face or puffiness around my eyes. And a lot of time when I'm out, you know, in the world, it looks to me like so many people are suffering from food allergies, including the doctor that I may go visit, you know, that it makes me think the whole country is just in denial about how prevalent food allergies are.
It's not even denial. It's a withholding of information, again, because of the restrictions by the Food and Drug Administration. Here's something that I thought was interesting that I think you might find interesting, and so will some of your listeners. You know, I'd encourage everybody to go and check out some of these sources. If I'm wrong, please let me know, and I'll go back and I'll fact check and I'll, you know, do more extensive homework. But go and check some of these sources. Check some of these things out. But one thing I want you to check out is go on the Stimulus website. And on the Stimulus website, you can apply for different types of research grants. And I went on the site, I think it was in November of last year, October or November of last year, and I did some research on that site looking for a research grant for food allergies and food allergy testing. And I looked at maybe six or seven different research grants, and I honed in on two that were food allergy specific, and both of these grants were very supportive to the research on food allergies as long as it didn't include one specific antibody that is called the IgG antibody that is indicated in like 85% of all the food allergies in the country. So I thought that was really, really interesting that they're going to give millions of dollars for research on stuff that's already been researched. And the stuff that really needs to be researched, they for some reason have been kind of stonewalling that for a very long time. So I thought that was really interesting.
Now, do you think that, I don't know how you feel about genetically modified foods, but do you think that they cause increased food allergies?
You know, I don't see why they shouldn't, but the way that I learned about delayed food allergies and hidden food allergies is that if you're allergic to corn, you're going to be allergic to genetically modified corn. So it doesn't necessarily matter if the food is genetically modified or not. There might be, I don't know, there really isn't a lot of research that I've seen that shows that it's really a difference. But the bottom line is this. We shouldn't be genetically modifying our food, and we shouldn't be genetically modifying our people. So the way that I look at it is that the planet has created all of this amazing food. We've learned all these great, amazing agricultural techniques that have gotten us through 15,000 or 20,000 years of human history. Why are we going to try and reinvent the wheel? Why are we going to try and fix something that isn't broken? If we just, like, really focused on certain foods like rice, quinoa, millet, a lot of the different types of vegetables, we can feed the world without a problem. You know, there are sea vegetables in the ocean that are literally unlimited that can cure every single mineral deficiency in the world. And yet we're still bent on genetically modifying soybeans. It doesn't make any sense, and it's just purely, corporate, life science company, world domination, which, again, it's like, I got no problem with people making money, just don't lie to people in the process and make a good product. You know, tell that to Microsoft.
There is great seafood. I've really started getting into the various different kinds of seaweeds. Like there's, and I may not say these properly, you know them better than I do, but there's something called dolph, which is like this reddish brown seaweed.
Yeah, dolph is something that you put in gomazio, which is a sesame seed seasoning. And it's really tasty. It's a good substitute for salt.
Well, I also, it's a good substitute for croutons in your soup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's great.
Especially if you make it, like, and I make my own homemade soup, so I don't put any salt in the soup, and then I put the dolls on it, like, croutons, and it has salt in it, and it's really, I love it.
Well, a great salt replacement for soup is just simple celery. Celery is very high in naturally occurring sodium, and you can throw celery in your soup. You can cook meat with celery, and it'll give it like a little bit of a salty flavor. Celery is great to throw in your soup. And also, when you're cooking your rice, if you want to cut down on your table salt, just throw in a square of kombu seaweed. That's K-O-M-B-U,
right.
Seaweed. And it's like a 1-inch by 1-inch square, and it's loaded with iodine, magnesium, trace minerals, naturally occurring sodium, which gives it that salty flavor, calcium. Sea vegetables are great, great, great food to go and add to any dish. But remember, it's got a very strong flavor, and it takes a little while to get used to. And if you don't like it, there are plenty of other sources of minerals that you can find from a variety of different ground-based vegetables and grains.
Well, yes. And I think that the whole point that you're trying to make here is that instead of us trying to invent new versions, genetically modified versions of the same food over and over again, we really ought to be exploring all those foods out there that we've never even tried. I know in your article you mentioned things like kohlrabi and kale and millet and amaranth. So I think that's what you're saying, is it?
Absolutely. There are so many different things out there to try. And, you know, one thing that we can use to get past this this food is entertainment, this emotional eating thing, is to create a lot of variety in our diets, to try new things every day so that every day is a new adventure. But it's an adventure where you're really benefiting from it instead of an adventure where, you know, like an adventure where, like, you're going, like, bobsledding or you're going skiing, as opposed to an adventure of, oh, my God, I got stopped by the cops today, I was speeding. Not that type of adventure. That's what we're used to with our nutrition, with our food, is we're used to those stressful adventures where you kind of like end the day on the couch in front of the TV, you know, mindlessly eating something that you picked up at Kentucky Fried Chicken on the way back. I'm not talking about that type of adventure where it just sucks the life out of you. I'm talking about an adventure where every time you sit down to your meal, you're like, ooh, what's this new thing I'm going to try today? Or what's this, I've never had this kind of breakfast before, and I'm really looking forward to it. Or I'm going to go and create a whole brand new salad with a whole bunch of new things, or maybe I'm going to combine something different. Like one thing that I did a long time ago, I was locked into the whole iceberg lettuce salad thing until I got into this stuff. So one day I decided to get some romaine lettuce and grilled chicken, you know, standard grilled chicken salad, but I threw some avocado, walnuts, Italian herbs, and some roasted sunflower seeds on it. And I've never done that before. And then I threw these gigantic, like, huge, pitted California olives in there. And I cannot tell you how much I love this salad. But I've never done something like that before. I mean, other people maybe they tried that. But I've never done that before. And that was like an actual experience I had with my food that I remember. I was sitting down at my desk. I was looking outside. It was a big tree out by my window where I was living at the time. And I was eating this out, and that was a really positive experience for me. And a lot of times you ask somebody what they ate for breakfast, they won't even tell you because they can't remember. like, oh God, I don't know. I think I had a donut or something. Or I had a Danish or in coffee. That's the whole point, is that if you have an experience with your food where you remember the experience and you can really, really feel like it had an impact on you, all of our meals should be, not all of them, but I'd say a large majority of them should be that way, because if you think about it, the food that we're putting in our bodies, is making our cells. It's making our blood. It's making our neurotransmitters. It's making our hormones, which I think is very important for some of your listeners, the hormonal aspect. And it's also making our vital organs. So it should be that the food that we put in our body is, to a certain degree, sacred. It doesn't have to be 100% sacred. It can be 90% sacred and then 10%, maybe a little bit more, fun and interesting. But that foundation really should be something where you're sitting down and you're having, like, a really good conversation with somebody who's a close friend. And this goes back to the emotional eating thing, where your food is like a relationship. You need to communicate with it. I don't mean sit down and talk to your Cheerios, but I mean it has to be something where, you know, it has to be something where you're kind of communicating with it and you're saying, okay, well, how is this going to make me feel? Just like, you know, you're not going to hang out with somebody that's going to make you feel like hell. Somebody that puts you down, makes fun of you, teases you, calls you fat and contagious. And you don't want to be around people like that. It's the same thing with food. You don't want to eat something that's going to make you feel like hell, even if something's supposed to be really healthy, like bean sprouts. Bean sprouts are really nutritious. They're really healthy. You can't pay me to eat them. Okay? It's just, you know, soybeans. Soybeans are very popular food. A lot of people are allergic to it.
I love mung bean sprouts.
Well, mung bean sprouts are great. You know, I love throwing it in soup. But you understand my point. It's not something that I'm, like, running home to eat because I'm looking forward to it.
True.
You know, I'm running home because I'm looking forward to that cast iron pan that I have and what new spice combinations I can come up with to go and put on a piece of steak. That gets me excited. Also, when I'm coming home and I got, you know, my whole big rainbow of vegetables in my refrigerator, and I whip something up that I've never seen before. So those are the types of things that's what I'm talking about, is to have this type of relationship with your food where you not just enjoy it, but it's an adventurous, pleasant, nutritious experience that's not just physically nutritious, but something that nourishes your intangible side, like your soul and your emotions. So, I mean, on one hand, we get into the scientific stuff, and on the other hand, we get into a lot of the spiritual and non-scientific things that are more felt and understood as opposed to concrete knowledge.
Well, speaking of the more, you know, concrete side of it, what is it that, you know, part of the government's, I guess it's the government, I don't even know who says this, but they came out with that whole BMI thing some time ago, and I'm wondering, can you explain to my listeners, first of all, what is a BMI,
and then why
should they care or not care?
Well, this is the reason why you should care, because this is a major part in the whole healthcare reform now, because what the BMI does is it allows the government to have a mandate on who is overweight and who isn't. It basically says that they can determine who is a higher risk and who gets less health insurance. This is something right now some insurance companies use, depending on what state you're in. But some insurance companies use the BMI as a means of determining who is at higher risk for diabetes or cancer or heart disease and so on and so forth, because this is what determines if somebody is overweight or not, according to this particular methodology. And what it does is it allows insurance companies to restrict health care coverage to people. And this is something that the United States federal government has bought into hook, line, and sinker. And what I think is really interesting is that, first off, the BMI means body mass index, and it's a calculated arbitrary number that is based on someone's height and weight that is transposed over a graph of age. So somewhere between 19 and 25 is like a normal number. And here, I have the statistics over here. But anything higher than 26 is considered overweight, and anything approaching 35 or 40 is considered obese, and anything higher than that is morbidly obese. But this statistic over here basically says that 66% of all American adults are overweight. But what was really funny is that on June 16th in 1998, that number was around 50%. On June 16th, 1998, that number was around 50%. Now, by June 17th, 1998, that number shot up by 25 million people.
Oh, my God.
This is because the National Institutes of Health, they changed the standards of the body mass index so that what happened was they lowered the weight that would be indicative of somebody being overweight. So overnight, nearly 30 million people in the United States of America became overweight. Overnight. Because they changed the standards. They did the same thing with the whole cholesterol thing, which boosted the sales of these statins and these anti-cholesterol drugs. But this is what they did, and the reason they were doing this was they were saying, well, it's becoming an increased health risk. But overnight, 25 million people became fat without doing anything. They woke up fat.
So what you're basically saying is that it's not that the government decided that they wanted to help more people, but that probably the lobbies behind the government wanted to sell more pills to people.
You know, that's the prevailing thought here. Obviously, I don't have the evidence for that. Nobody really does. But I think it's interesting that when this happened, bariatric surgery and weight loss surgeries, which are not covered by most insurance companies, not until recently, now they're starting to cover it because people are demanding it. But back then, it was an elective surgery, from what I understand, and these weight loss surgeries have skyrocketed since then. And now you see a lot of celebrities that are doing the weight loss surgery. And I'm thinking to myself, I mean, doesn't anybody exercise anymore? You know, I mean, it's just something that drives me a little bit crazy because I think it's something that is being promoted as like this amazing surgery that people should consider as a weight loss option. But yet they never test anybody for food allergies. They never go through someone's lifestyle. They never look at inflammatory indicators. They just look at somebody's body mass index and say, okay, well, you need to take these weight loss pills or you need to do this type of surgery or we're going to put you on this type of restrictive diet. And this is the thing I think is funny. This is going back to the whole food guide pyramid thing. They're saying that if you want to lose weight, if you want to be of normal weight, and fit within those parameters of 19 to 25 on the BMI, you need to have a diet that's somewhere between 1,300 and 1,850 calories a day for the average American. The problem is that all of the dietary and nutritional guidelines are based on 2,000 to 2,500 calories a day. It makes no sense whatsoever. So on one hand, they're saying, okay, well, we want you to eat 2,000 to 2,500 calories a day. We want you to eat 275 to 300 carbohydrates a day and X amount of fat. We want you to, that's what we want you to do. That's to be healthy. But if you want to be of normal weight, you need to eat less than that. So it's completely confusing. And it's something that and now you have the White House doing this whole war on obesity. How about a war on the bureaucratic garbage that got us in this place in the first place? How about going to the FDA and the USDA and saying, look, you guys need to be more consistent with this stuff. How much do we need to eat in order to not be fat? Tell us the truth. Why is it that people are overweight eat less food than people who are underweight? Why is that? So they're not answering these questions.
I'm sure people would like to hear. So you're saying that people who eat more food weigh less?
That's the information that I've gotten, that calorie-restrictive diets don't work. And the reason why they don't work is because of, you know, when you start drastically, dramatically cutting your calories, the body goes into a famine state. And when the body goes into a famine state, it does a whole bunch of wacky things. And this is why some people that cut their calories actually put on more weight. But it's really unpredictable. When you start dealing with mathematics and with numbers and with calories, you're getting into a territory where you're focusing on 1% of a really, really, really big, broad spectrum of things to focus on. But from the information that I've seen from, especially people in the food allergy realm, people of normal weight tend to consume more calories than people who are overweight. Here's why. Because people who are overweight, like I'm not talking about people that you look at and say, you're not overweight, you know, you're just, you know, really hot and you're curvaceous or whatever. I'm not talking about people that look normal. I'm talking about people who are very overweight and it's something that is very noticeable. I'm talking about that small percentage of the population. Those people tend to eat less, but they also move less. That's the prevailing thought. Okay, I'm not saying it's the case all the time, but I'm saying this is the prevailing thought. So they don't really exercise. They don't have an active lifestyle. So they're not really metabolizing and utilizing the energy they take in. Makes sense, right?
Right.
But people that are of normal weight, regardless as to how much they eat calorically, they tend to be more active. The people that are right in the middle, they tend to be people that are athletic or people that have active lifestyles or people that are going out a lot, people that have low stress. They use more energy than people who are overweight. So that's why, I think getting people to exercise is a great idea, but you don't do it by demonizing those people, by saying, you're fat, you need to exercise. That doesn't work. It doesn't work, and what it does, it causes people to eat emotionally because they're upset, their feelings are hurt, and they need comfort of an ice cream sundae. So, that doesn't work. But there are a couple of things that really, I think, need to be looked at here. The body mass index thing needs to be thrown out the window because there's so many holes in that pseudoscience, it's not even funny. It is not a good indicator. It is not a good indicator of somebody who's overweight or underweight because here's the problem. The majority of people in the United States of America don't fall within the normal range. So normal is actually bigger. Yet, there's no standard that the BMI is based on. And a lot of people throw it out the window, especially athletes. Because athletes, people that are heavily muscled, because muscle is more dense than fat, so
right.
It, quote, weighs more than fat, athletes are actually overweight. Like 70% of athletes are overweight on that body mass index. I'm not talking about, offensive linemen or defensive linemen on a professional football team. I'm talking the third baseman for the Atlanta Braves. I'm talking about, Alex Rodriguez, Peyton Manning. I'm talking about people that you look at and you say, oh my God, that guy looks like he was chiseled out of granite. Yes, he's overweight. According to the body mass index, athletes, professional athletes, high school athletes, and college athletes get slammed on this. They're overweight. And also what it does is it gives people this false idea that they're bigger than they really are. So this is where you have disordered eating and eating disorders and low confidence and depression. Ooh, depression, more medication. So we got to get the BMI out, and we got to get the government out of this whole, weighing thing. I know Mike Huckabee is a very, very nice guy, but I do not support this idea of weighing children every week in school. That is absolutely ludicrous. That is
absolutely ludicrous. He wants to weigh children in school every week?
That's what he did in Arkansas. I mean, when he was the governor of Arkansas. I love the guy. I think he's a really, really nice man. But no, there's no way. I would never support that. Okay, so I have a problem with the left and the right here. I have a problem with Michelle Obama and this whole idea of the war on obesity. And I have a problem with Mike Huckabee wanting to weigh children. No. Why don't both of you guys mind your own business and let's get the real information out there to people and start educating people, about real food the same way that our grandparents were educated by their parents and their parents' parents.
It seems
the way that
like
learned
it would
about
be
food.
A much better thing to have children getting outside and playing and put PE. I mean, a lot of schools have actually phased out physical education now. It's not even a mandatory.
Well, again, that's a whole other political issue in and of itself that is something that I'm probably not even qualified to get into, but that's public education and lack of funding. And what they do is they phase out the things that are easiest to phase up. They fire gym teachers and they just, you know, have people, have the children go to lunch without having any type of recess or having any type of PE. But the first thing that needs to happen, we've got to get the BMI and get government bureaucrats out of nutrition and out of weight loss. Get them out of it. The second thing that has to happen is I think there has to be a reevaluation of body image in this country, because we are so locked into this airbrushed cover of Cosmo, Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, you know, Taylor Swift, you know, false sense of beauty. And it's like, that's great. They look great when on the cover. That's wonderful. When they wake up in the morning, they look just like everybody else. And nobody knows this unless they're reading The Inquirer. And I think a lot of women, unfortunately, they get really upset thinking like, well, if I'm going to be beautiful or attractive, I have to look like that. And that's not the case.
And yeah, I remember Sybil Shepherd. She's an actress who was, when she was 16 years ago, she was on every cover of every major magazine in the world. And somebody asked her, what was that like? What was it like to be on the cover of every magazine in the world? And she looked at the interviewer and she said, I wished I was as pretty as the girl in the picture.
Yeah,
I thought that was so brave and so honest of her, because, of course, everybody else is terrified that they're not going to look as good as their picture, and so they're always trying to show up and pretend that they do.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a really great point, and I think body image is absolutely huge. And I think when you have people that are spreading misinformation, like this whole ridiculous idea that people who are fat, their behaviors are contagious, that's going to make you fat too. That's absolutely ludicrous. So that means, you know, when I played football, you know, the half a dozen, you know, 300-pound offensive linemen that I went and ate hot wings with after every practice and after every game, I was going to become fat like them. It's totally not the case. I'm 5'9". The shortest guy was 6'2", 275 pounds. By hanging out with these guys, I was going to get fat? Absolute nonsense. It's completely scientifically, there's no scientific corroboration or even epidemiological corroboration. It's just hearsay, and it's just something that's made up to go and push a, you know, some sort of an agenda.
Now,
so this whole idea of body image.
Michael, yeah, getting back to that, I just want to say we actually have a comment here from one of our listeners. Vivian Reed says, in answer to my question, I said, does the wellness industry exploit women's body image? And Vivian Reed says, short answer, hell yes. That's all she had to say about it.
Yeah, I mean, they do.
But can you tell, you know, if you had to summarize it in like, you know, one or two sentences, how is it the wellness industry is taking advantage of women's body image, and do you think you know why?
Well, if I had to break it down into one or two sentences, the first thing I would do is I would look at how the wellness industry needs to make money. Just like every other industry, they need to make money. But the way that the majority of people do it is by getting really, really, really excited about a product and then using any means possible to sell that product, which means preying on people's fears, on their ignorance, on their lack of education, on their misinformation, guilting people. Like the whole raw food thing is primarily based on fear and guilting people into eating foods that they probably wouldn't eat before. Not that I'm saying there's anything wrong with raw food, but, you know, the movement behind it can be a little bit questionable. And the supplement industry is the most corrupt out of all of them. This whole idea that you can get vitamin D from a pill, when yet vitamin D is not even a significant nutrient in the diet. It's something that you get from going out in the sun. You know, it's ridiculous. And then these B vitamin pills that 96% of all the B vitamins that you get in these pills that come out in your urine, and the best source of B vitamins will always be a grain or a root vegetable.
Michael, which root vegetables are a good source of that vitamin B?
You know, sweet potatoes, I think the skin of sweet potatoes are very high in vitamin B. I think parsnips have some vitamin B in it, too. Basically, anything brown is going to have a lot of vitamin D in it, or the B vitamins. Yeah.
And that also applies to red meat, does it, or no?
Red meat?
Yeah. Am I wrong?
Well, red meat is red because of the iron content. And vitamin B12 is what's the B vitamin that you would get from red meat.
Okay.
But that's a whole other situation. And the second thing I would say about the wellness industry is that there are a lot of people that are selling products that are, or not just selling products, but just that are promoting products or services, and they really don't have an understanding of what those products and services are about. So they're just, you know, trying to push their livelihood. And I got no problem people making money, but I got a problem with people saying, "You're bad the way you are, but I'm going to fix you. So you're going to take these bottle of pills. You're going to do this treatment. You're going to do this. You don't understand any of these things. That's because it's too sophisticated for some simpleton like you to understand." When what I think is really amazing is that the father of wellness and the father of modern Western medicine, Hippocrates, said, "Let thy food be thy medicine, and thy medicine be thy food." The guy who started it all said that food is medicine, guys. You know, you need to take that into consideration. You take a Hippocratic oath, but you leave out the parts that you don't like. You know,
Michael, let me ask you something here. I put a question out on Facebook. I said, "What is your best diet? Are you on it now? And do you believe in diet? What do you think is healthy?" We've got a comment here, and maybe you can give us a little feedback. His name is Ray Sawhill, and he said he's into paleo, lowish carb, Franco, which means lots of meat, fish, fowl, good quality, wariness of carbs, especially sugar and wheat, and total fearlessness where high-quality fats go. Not so much a diet as an easy way to feel good, enjoy life and food, and not get fat. Works, so what do you think? You're the expert here. What do you think about that?
If it works for him and he feels great, you know, fine. Don't, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I just don't like to put labels on any type of dietary protocol, because the people that were eating the Paleolithic diet when it was the Paleolithic time, they never put a label on it. So I just don't like putting labels on dietary approaches. But if that works for him, then by all means, you know, keep working with it until it doesn't work for you anymore, and then be open to change.
And is that one of the main messages that you have, really, is that the idea that there is one good way of eating out there that we should all conform to is perhaps misguided?
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you think that there's one standard sexual practice for people to have?
No, absolutely
there's
not.
There's one way to be sexual.
Nope,
would you say that? No. Okay, well then it's the same thing with food. There is no one size fits all nutrition or diet for people, because it really is the individual that determines what the individual's needs are. Now the problem arises when the individual has a need and they know they have a need, but they don't know how to meet that need. They don't know how to fulfill that need. So what happens is they go to an outside source like the government, the wellness industry, the medical industry, and they say, "Feed me." And they say, "Eat this." "Okay, but it makes me feel like hell. What do I do?" "Well, you need to eat it because you don't know any better." That's wrong. The problem comes when people don't know how to fulfill those needs. And that's one of the things that I aim to do, is find out, what do you need, what do you want, what will make the quality of your life better? Well, I don't really know, but I know that I need something. Okay, well, let's go and let's find a way of meeting that need. Let's go and find a way of meeting your nutrition needs, your emotional needs, your spiritual needs, your physical needs. Because then when you look at those things, that's the whole basis behind holistic health and holistic nutrition. It's not a bottle of pills. It's not some sort of magic wand. It's an approach that improves the quality of that person's life. It doesn't let you live to be 125 years old, like some of these diets proclaim. It just means that we are going to work together to help you get what you want out of your life. And I guess from a nutritional standpoint, with this idea that there is no one-size-fits-all, that it's up to the individual, you know, it's kind of like a very liberated, very libertarian approach to nutrition, where it's like the government doesn't know, the doctors don't know, the dietitians don't know, the wellness industry don't know. The only person that knows is you. And we just need to get you the resources that will help you fulfill that need, will help you create that type of lifestyle that you want. And by understanding things like, you know, understanding the nutritional breakdown of milk, and by understanding how to combine root vegetables and green leafy vegetables to create a complete nutritional profile, you know, understanding food allergies, which is probably the X factor in this entire thing, getting out of this 7 to 10 food rut that everybody is in, and starting to create more variety and more excitement and more of a systematic approach to nutrition that's more aligned with what the person wants and what the person needs, gives somebody the ability where they're independent, where they're liberated, what I call nutritional independence, where, you know, they're not a slave to their emotions. They're not a slave to their food. They're not a slave to the wellness industry that's telling them everything to get them to buy a product or to go on a diet. They're not a slave to the medical industry that's saying, well, your cholesterol is too high, so you need to go on all these drugs. Instead, you say, well, I know foods I could eat to go and drop that. You know, instead of being a slave to the government where they says everybody is fat, so we need to go and wage war on them. Instead, you say, well, I like who I am, and you can't go and take that away from me. That's the whole point of being nutritionally independent.
I love your passion and your enthusiasm. We're going to have to wrap things up here, but I think basically what you're talking about here is empowering people to be in charge of their own diet and their own health and their own bodies. And would you say that's a fair assessment?
Absolutely. Anything else is fascism.
Well, I love that. I love that. Now, tell in the last minute here that we've got, can you tell my listeners how they can contact you and, you know, give them the website, phone number, email, whatever you want them to have?
Well, I'll give the 1-800 number first. It's 877-880-2023. That's extension 705. And it's 877-880-2023. And that's extension 705. Also, you can check out my website, which will be updated very soon, and it's called staffoflifenutrition.com. That's Staff of Life Nutrition, Staff, S-T-A-F-F, of Life Nutrition.com. And the email is staffoflifenutrition@gmail.com. Drop me an email, check out the website, which again will be updated, give me a call, and, you know, I'd love to be of assistance to anybody out there, but also see if we can create some more awareness.
And we should mention too that, you not only, I think you work with people over the phone around the world, but you also have...
It's more environmentally friendly.
Yeah, you've also got teleseminars that you do. I think sometimes you invite people to audit those for free. So,
I think we have one coming up on Thursday.
I find them really informative, and I've actually been studying nutrition most of my life. It's something a path my mother put me on when I was just a little girl. So, I usually know more about nutrition than most lay people, but I learned so much from you, Michael. You're right on the cutting edge, and it's really a lot of fun.
Well, I thank you for those kind words, but if I have to tell you where it comes from, I just love food, and I love eating, and I love seeing people happy. So if I can have those things all at the same time, that's all it takes, is just happy people eating happy food.
Yes, and I love the fact that you're always chiding me for feeling guilty about food. So.
Well, yeah, because you don't feel guilty about anything else, and, like, here I am, like, you know, Mr., like, you know, wearing like a, you know, turtleneck and everything, being all reserved. But when it comes to food, I'm like an absolute, like an orgy. And like with you, it's like, oh my God, if I eat this, am I gonna like, is this gonna kill me for like 3 months and everything?
I'm
like,
I'm totally shame based around food.
You know, like with me, with sex, it's just kind of like, you guys can go and talk about this. I'm gonna go eat a brownie.
<There you go. laughs>
And it actually happened.
And that's why I keep having you back into the shame-free zone, sweetheart, because I'll tell you something. I have found people are, you know, they got shame around sex. They've also got shame around money. They got shame around food. We're just kind of a shame-based culture. So thank God for people like you that can kind of, you know, help us free up and realize we are supposed to enjoy eating.
Yeah, we don't need any John Calvin puritanical people like trying to tell us that our food is hellfire and brimstone.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, let's just all have a fiesta and just enjoy what we're doing and just make sure that we get it right most of the time. And you don't have to get it right all the time. You can completely screw up every now and then, and it ain't gonna kill you.
Right.
Unless there's arsenic in it, then you got a whole big problem that I really don't have the answers for.
Okay. All right, Michael Joseph, thank you so much for coming into the Shame Free Zone. I'm sure we'll have you on again, and good luck with the book you're working on.
Thank you so much, Veronica, and have a wonderful, wonderful evening.
Thank you. You too. I think I'm going to go eat
something. Here, guys.
Good night.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you.